Redemption is a common thread that runs through the Bible, and today's message is simply called The Need for Redemption, based in verses 8 to 22 of the first chapter of the Exodus. Now remember, Exodus is just the second season of the great show called the Pentateuch or the Torah, as each one develops on the previous season. And of course, we've looked in Genesis and seen God dealing there. And then we saw simply the sketchy little glimpse of 400 years that takes place at the beginning of Exodus. It's hard to even comprehend that Genesis ended with Joseph and his family moving to Egypt in 1876 BC. And then, all of a sudden, we see what's happening to the Jews in 1576 and down to the birth of Moses and the Exodus in 1445 and 46 BC. And so, huge time frame that we only see sketchy details as God emphasizes the good that he intended to bring, not the evil. Now, if Exodus were put into a movie, and I know there have been a couple made that are pretty untrue to the Bible account, but if it was made into a headlines of a newspaper or TV, you would see pictures of the Jews sweating and afflicted and walking around in the slime pit making mud bricks with their feet, and you would see evil Egyptians beating them with whips and rods. You would see the helpless refugees being mistreated by the Egyptians, and you would see all these different things on the news accounts. But we're told of these events that took place simply to show the picture of the need for redemption, of what God was doing in that 400 plus year period of time, that God had a purpose, God had a promise, God had a people. And the thrust of chapter 1 is not Egypt and how evil it was, but it was on how good God was helping to strengthen and provide and grow his people so that they could become a nation to go and conquer Canaan, conquer the promised land, and live there theoretically happily ever after, but we know that didn't happen either. So there are four reasons that are given in these scriptures in Exodus chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, four reasons for the redemption of God's people from Egypt. And obviously, there are parallels to today that are most of them so obvious that I don't need to spend a long time preaching on them. The first reason is the political oppression of the people of God. We see the motivation, what is happening here. In Exodus chapter 1, verse 8, it said, "There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." When Joseph brought his family to the promised land, he had told them that they would have the best of the land, that they would have, that's in Genesis 47, verse 11, that they would live in Goshen, in the area outside of the main Nile Valley, out here in an area that would be good pasture land, very fertile, but it would be kind of off on the edge of Egypt so that there wouldn't be a lot of interaction, because the Egyptians did not want to have interrelations with the Jews. They were just kind of foreign guests who were living there in this time of famine, paying for their food and so forth. But the problem happened when a whole new regime began. Shortly after Joseph and his family came down, another group of Semitic people from up towards Turkey and Syria along that area, they also came down to Egypt, and they were welcomed in because Egypt had an open border policy. You can see where this is going. They didn't have a wall. They said, okay, we'll just let you come on in as long as you work and you pay your taxes. And Egyptian taxes were simply you work for the Pharaoh for 2 months out of the year. And you paid 1/6 of your wages, as it were, to the government. Probably a parallel to a lot of our tax rates still today. But they came down and about the same time. And what happened was this group that came with the Hebrews, which were 70 people, were a group of a few hundred, and they were called the Hyksos, H-Y-K-S-O-S. And the Hyksos came down, and they grew in power. And when the Egyptian pharaoh became weak, they took over the government. And so from 1725 to 1567, in what's called the second intermediate period between the different kingdoms of the Egyptians, it was ruled by these Asiatic invaders, as it were. And they took control of it, and they ruled the government. They took on the title of pharaoh. They worshiped the Egyptian gods. And they put on all sorts of new regulations because they didn't want anybody to overthrow them. And that included more work, more tax burden, more pressure on the Jews who were living there, but also on all of the Egyptians. This continued. The Jews continued to thrive as a people and grow in great number, but they were under the Hyksos rule until 1567. Then a new king restored the power of the pharaoh. They restored Egyptian rule in 1567 BC. His name was Ahmoses, easy to remember, just A-H, and then Moses, the first. He reunited all of Egypt. He defeated the Ethiopians and Cush. He defeated the black Africans from Nubia down in Ethiopia and the Sudan, and reunited and drove out the Hyksos usurpers that were there and started the 18th dynasty. Now you're saying this sounds like a history class. You got to know what we're talking about because the Bible just says, oh, you know this. You know, a new king came. And we're all going, huh? We know the king's name is Pharaoh, right? Actually, Pharaoh is a title like president or Caesar. In Germany, Kaiser, we or queen or whatever you might use there. But with the real Egyptians back in control, the foreigners became suspect. They drove out the Hyksos, but here were these great number now of Jews who for hundreds of years had been living, paying their taxes, doing their work, not Egyptians, not intermarrying with the Egyptians, but they were there. But now we have a new king coming in of the Egyptian dynasty, the Pharaoh dynasty. And every foreign group was suspect, especially a large, powerful group like the Jews had begun. Verse 9, we pick up the results. This is why there's political oppression. The results is that the Pharaoh said to his people in verse 9, see, the people of Israel are now too many and too powerful for us. There was a proud sense of racial superiority among the Egyptians. They looked down on the Jews because they were farmers, they were shepherds, we don't like them. They're out there living by themselves, they have their own religion, they worship their own God. And there's too many of them now. It's a difficult time, we've got to do something. They were not slaves, but they were like serfs. Not Smurfs. Some of you are thinking little blue people. No, they were like serfs, S-E-R-F, in Europe, where a serf would be given land. Most of his produce and work would go to the lord or the knights or the king or whoever, and they'd be able to keep a little bit for their own family to feed themselves. But they were really in virtual well, it's called serfdom, but I just call it slavery. It isn't like they were in chains. It isn't like we think of slavery in the sense of what happened in the 15 to 1700 era of slavery in the world of the blacks, but more of slavery like it was back in the Roman era, where they were the servants, sometimes teachers, professional workers, but they didn't have freedom to just do what they wanted to do. And so the king is fearful of being outnumbered. He's fearful that this group of Jews, like the Hyksos, would take over and destroy his 18th Egyptian dynasty and take over the world. And also, he said, they're too many and they're too powerful. He said, we've got to be careful here, because think about this. If we're invaded by the Hittites or the Assyrians or others from Mesopotamia, if they come down, what is the first group that they're going to meet? They're going to meet this large group, hundreds of thousands of non-Egyptians. And they're going to link up with them. And, you know, we've got to be careful here. We've got an enemy right on our border. I'm convinced that Ahmosis would be there lobbying the parliament in Egypt to say, hey, we've got a problem right on our border. We've got to do something with them. We've got to stop these people. They become too many. In verse 10, he says, we have to deal shrewdly, deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, which they were doing like proverbial rabbits. They were having babies. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us. And then worse, what if they just leave? Look at all the work they're doing. They're spending months every year working for us. And if they leave, we're going to have to do that work. We need these illegal Jews that are down here. We need these aliens living here doing the work. We don't want to lose our workforce. So the politician came out, as it were, in the Pharaoh. And he said, okay, we've got to handle this. We've got to get a handle on all of this area here, or we're going to lose our government. We're going to lose our nation. Political oppression. This happens all over the world today, where small groups with ideas take over a country. Someone was celebrating the October Revolution, which happened in November, by the way, but the old calendar had it in October, when the communists took over in the Soviet Union. But they don't realize that there was a great rebellion in Russia against the Tsar, against the unfair working conditions and the virtual serfdom of the people there. And there was a tremendous revolution, but it was headed by good people. It was headed by people who wanted to make Russia like the U.S., Kerensky and others, who wanted a constitution modeled after ours. But a little vocal group of communists literally usurped that revolution, and within 3 years had killed off the white Russians and became the red Russians. And we just think of it as the Russian Revolution and don't realize that there was really a small group that took over. And this can happen in any nation. The fear, and so politicians make laws, they make walls, they make rules. Adolf Hitler, as we all know, made the Jews live in certain areas so that everyone could see who they were. Then they had to wear yellow stars on their clothing so people walking in a normal street would see them and know that they were not a real German, even though some of them had been their families for literally thousands of years. Political oppression. And folks, it's happening today in countries like Indonesia, in Malaysia, where Christian groups are being persecuted. They're being taxed out of existence. They're being beaten and in many cases killed because the government doesn't want them to control. They don't want them to have an influence. They want the people to blindly follow the leadership. We're told that the fastest growing church in the world today is in China, where people are becoming Christians by the tens of thousands every week. In America, nominal Christian church attendance is dropping by tens of thousands every week. But the political oppression was such that shrewdly, carefully, the Pharaoh said, we need to work it out to stop this group, to thwart God's plan. Political oppression will always show itself in money. You know, follow the money. That's a clever phrase. Maybe I'll be quoted on that. The idea that there's a financial aspect of it brings about the second reason for the oppression of the Jews, and that's economic. God's people are oppressed economically. Verse 11 says, therefore, because of the political decisions, therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built Pharaoh's store cities of Pithom and Ramses. Virtual enslavement now. They were intimidated. They were oppressed. It wasn't just working 2 months. It was working whenever the Pharaoh asked you to. It was having enough, perhaps, to sustain your family, but everything else went to the government. Taskmaster is an actual technical term for overseers of forced labor and slavery. It's a term that is emphasized in the scripture with words like they were oppressed and burdened and given difficult labor and so forth. Demoralizing, frightening. You can't fight against City Hall. Can't fight against the Pharaoh. Can't fight. This is really bad. It had been hundreds of years. Our nation's been growing. It's been getting stronger and stronger. And now we're getting more and more oppressed. And the burden is much worse. Now, they weren't building the pyramids. Somebody said, is that when the pyramids, the Jews built the pyramids, right? No, the pyramids were already 1,000 years old, okay? Think of 2500 BC when the pyramids were, now we're down in the 1500s. But it was difficult labor. They were oppressed. They were given difficult challenges and tasks to do. And so they built these great store cities, places where food for famine and weapons for war were being built right in the area of Goshen, right in the Jewish homeland area where they had been given to live. Yet, verse 12, you have it there? Verse 12, Exodus 1:12. Yet, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians lived in dread of the Israelis. You can't get rid of them, no matter what we do. We oppress them, we make them work, it's evil, and they keep having babies. Every time we look around, there's another bar mitzvah. Every time the Jews are growing and growing, and it's becoming difficult. Genesis 47 says that they increased in the time of Joseph when they first moved down there. Remember, there's only 70 people that came down in 1876. 75 by New Testament numbers, because they include the children of Ephraim and Manasseh in that number. But the Bible says 70 Jews. How long would it take 70 Jews to become a great, powerful nation of 1 million, 2 million people? Well, let me help you do the math, because we all love math, right? I can just see your faces excited in that. How many people came to America at Jamestown in 1607? Does anybody know about approximately?
Some.
70, 170, okay, there's, I don't know, I'm asking you. That's a good teacher. He doesn't know the answers. He asks the students, and thank you. I'm assuming that, you know, Bill is Googling it right now. And and we'll come up with the answer in a minute. Just yell it out when you find it. So that's how America started, okay? With a couple hundred people in 1607. What did we have 400 years later? See the parallel here, 400 years later? 320 million. So to say that 70 Jews came down and 400 years later there were 600,000 men and 1.5 million women and children, not unreasonable at all. 144 came at Jamestown. Thank you very much. God was increasing his people. It happened under Joseph. It happened in Exodus 1:7 that we read in the last sermon. And now it's continuing. No matter what happened to them, they kept having babies. They kept growing. And by the way, this was God's purpose. Did you realize that? This was his purpose for Israel to use Egypt as a mother's womb for developing their nation. 70 Jews scattered all over Canaan with all of these pagan religions and cities and all controlled by the kingdom of Mari and we call them Amorites from the kingdom of Mari and other places all over the land. If the Jews settled there, they would not be strong enough to conquer one city. If 70 Jews settled there, how long would it be until their daughters saw some good-looking hunk Canaanite dude and said, whoa, that's great. And how until those nice Jewish boys saw those nice, sweet Jewish girls with their veils and very modest, and then they looked at all these Canaanite women, you know, half-dressed, dancing to the rock music or whatever they were doing. I don't know exactly what's going on. You can make up your own story here. It would have been a mess. There would have been no nation in a few years. But down in Egypt, they're living as a group. They're worshiping as a group. The Egyptians don't want anything to do with them. They have laws that said you can't marry a Jew. You can't even eat with a Jew. And so they grew into a mighty nation that would be powerful and strong doing physical labor to be able to go up and wipe out the Canaanites, as God said, destroy them, men, women, children, kill them all, and take over their land. 400 years. By the way, God was gracious because he was given the Canaanites 400 years to repent, to turn to him. And they wouldn't. God was still doing that so that his people could have this new land. See, persecution to us seems like a giant tidal wave coming in and destroying everything. In reality, persecution is like this giant wave, but we're like in a boat and it's propelling us faster and faster. But we just see the big waves. We see the storms and we shake our heads and say, oh, this is terrible. This is deep. Every day for these Jews, the situation got worse. Look at verses 13 and 14 as we see the results of this economic oppression. So with severity, they made the Israelis work like slaves. They made life bitter with hard surface, building with brick and mortar and various types of field work. I don't know how many of you have ever made brick. Any of you ever done that? Get mud, you know, you have a form made out of wood, and you put in mud, you put in straw. Today, I suppose we put in rebar and cement and things like that, but they put that in there, stamp it all down, pound it in there, get it thicker and thicker, get that mold, set it out in the sun, take the mold off, set it down, get a new batch of mud and straw, and started the process again. I know how difficult it is because I did that. In 1969 on the Navajo Indian Reservation, I did mission work. And we made adobe bricks, sun-dried clay bricks to build a church. after 2 days of that, and by the way, it's back-breaking, just want to let you know. You do all that, and then you have to flip them over after they dry on one side, make sure they're formed, let the sun bake them again. You have to continue to flip them over. The Jews were required, each Jew had to make 2,000 bricks a day. We find that from the record in the temple in Thebes in Egypt, where it showed the Jews stomping down the mud, and that they had to do 2,000, 40 slaves had to do 2,000 bricks each every day. Now, obviously, there'd be process of setting out for days in the sun, but you're working with thousands of these bricks. I did that until they found me and my brother-in-law, and he's 6'4", I was 6'6", and they said, okay, we've got enough bricks now. We're going to pile up these adobe bricks, but we need tall people to hold up the beams of the church. And so they said, you tall guy, me, you guys stand there and hold up, and we'll slide bricks in underneath till we get that there. Then you go and pick up a new beam. You know, they only weighed a couple hundred pounds. And lift it up and hold it there till we... And we built the entire church on the reservation outside Bloomfield, New Mexico. And that is hard work. I'm allergic to that kind of work. Okay, I break out in sweat and things. Oh, it's horrible. You just don't want to even think about it. A difficult time. These Jews made bricks. These Jews worked in the field. These Jews dug the irrigation ditches from the Nile that it spread out all through the region to make it fertile. They were being treated unjustly. And you know, the scriptures tell us about how to treat laborers like that. Psalm 99 verse 4 says, the mighty king loves justice. Psalm 103 verse 6, the Lord executes acts of righteousness and justice for the oppressed. Psalm 146 4 through 7, we have the references written down for you. He executes justice for the oppressed. He gives food to the hungry. He sets the prisoners free. He opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down because he loves the righteous. He watches over the sojourners, the immigrants who are there. He watches and upholds the widows and the fatherless. But the way of the wicked he brings to ruin. And in Deuteronomy, before Moses dies, after the Exodus is about over and he's writing it as they're getting ready to invade Canaan, Deuteronomy 10, he says that he executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. And then he says, therefore love the sojourner, because you were once sojourners in the land of Egypt. That wasn't your home, but you lived there. And you know what it's like. You know how difficult it is to love them. And so the Jews are mistreated. They're burdened. They're working like virtual slaves. It's getting worse and worse. This is now between that 1576, when the 18th dynasty began, and 1525 and the birth of Moses, which will come up in another chapter. This is the setting. This is what was happening. They were working without pity. The end of verse 14 says, in all this labor, they, the Egyptians, treated them, the Jews, without pity. They wanted to hurt the children of Israel. They wanted to crush them. They wanted them to be under the political and economic thumb of Pharaoh so they could never leave, so they could never rebel, so they could never join with enemies. They wanted to hurt the children of Israel, but they could not defeat God's plan. If you take away one thing from this, recognize that today there's economic oppression. There are Christians who are losing their jobs. You say, well, yeah, over in, where did you say, Indonesia or somewhere? No. How about in America? If you're a baker that says, I'm not going to bake a cake for perversion, I'm not going to celebrate evil, and the government says, okay, we'll penalize you. Freedom, oh, you don't really understand what it means. Freedom is to do what we say you can do. And they treat believers without pity. We're the bad guys. We're the enemy. We're the ones that are making problems. If we just bowed our head and said, yes, sir, master, I'd be good, they would be happy. Well, the political and economic oppression led to all of society opposing the Jews. All of them were now joined against God's people. And so we see the social or society's oppression of God's people. You have it there now in verse 15? Exodus 1:15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, beauty, and the other named Puah, which is splendor. And they said, when you serve as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birthing basins, some will say birthing stool or birthing chair or something like the birthing stones, the birthing basin, if you see it's a boy, if you see it's a son, kill him. If it's a girl, if it's a daughter, she shall live. The government says, we have a new morality. We have a new system. Wrong is now right. Right is now wrong. You see why I said there's a lot of parallels in this passage? This one's obvious. Because 5 out of 9 black-robed justices simply said that we don't care what the law said. We don't care what your state did. We're saying you can kill babies. You can kill babies from the moment they're conceived until 1 minute before they are delivered at birth. Now they're allowing some to say, even after they're born, if there's a defect or a problem, you can simply set the baby aside. In other words, put it in a bassinet, put it in a closet somewhere, and let it die. See, what kind of wicked people would do that? All these evil Egyptians, right? Almost all obeyed. Government made a law. But it was genocide. He doesn't use the word female or male. They actually use the Hebrew words son and daughter. If you see these babies, we want to get rid of the Jews. How can we do it in one generation? First of all, we kill all the boys. And then we take all the girls and put each girl in an Egyptian household as a sex slave, as it were. And in one generation, they're gone. The old generation dies out. There are no more Jews. What a wonderful government solution. We'll call it the final solution. Term used by Adolf some years later. Satan's plan of Jew hatred has continued through the century, but the attack on the Messiah, the attack on the bloodline, an unworkable, evil plan. Who would kill innocent babies? And who would be responsible? Did the Pharaoh go and kill the babies? No, he said, you Jewish midwives, we want you to do it. You see the baby boy born? You go to take that baby and you put it in the birthing basin, water-hewn rock basin, and just hold it on. As you're washing that new baby off, you just hold it under the water just for a few extra seconds, if it's a boy. And then you look and you say, oh, Mom, I'm so sorry, the baby is dead. And children dying, or babies in childbirth, is very common anyway. I was thinking, how many Jewish women after this became a pattern that all the boy babies mysteriously died and all the daughters lived? I wonder how many of them are thinking, wait a minute, maybe we don't need midwives after all. Maybe we'll just take our chances without it. I think the whole plan was poorly conceived, so to speak. The idea here, it was a decree of desperation, but look at what happened. Oh, I love it. But, verse 17, the midwives feared God and didn't do as the king commanded them, but let the male children live. They feared Pharaoh. They feared the government. They feared his power. They feared the physical oppression. They feared the economic oppression. They feared the political fallout. They had read that you're to obey the authorities, that we serve God by being obedient to the ones in charge. But when the laws and the ones in charge tell you to defy the word of God, what do? You fear God. We need to have that on our t-shirts instead of that no fear logo that they had on the t-shirts with big rage some years ago. Should now say fear God. The apostles stood on the same thing. Remember when Jesus rose and went to heaven and the apostles are preaching on the day of Pentecost, and then they went in chapter 3 and they were preaching and teaching in the temple. The authorities called them in and said, you can't do it. We're passing a law. You can't do it. And they said, Acts 4:18, they called them and charged them not to speak or teach in the name of Jesus. And Peter and John answered and said, whether it's right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than God, you judge. We'll pay the penalty. But we can't help but speak and teach the truth. We're not going to change. You can make the law all you want. We fear God more than we fear man. Oh, I wish that were true today. The fallout came in verses 18 and 19. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, what have you done, allowing the male children to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the lazy Egyptian women. They're vigorous. They're healthy. They give birth before we can even come. Now, was that a lie? No. That's truth. They didn't give the whole story. They didn't give all the details that they were saving the babies, but they were obeying God. And the Pharaoh was infuriated. And then to tell him that the Hebrew women were hardier than the Egyptian women, you know, that flew in the face of his racial pride there, and it was really irritating. So they didn't explain all the reasons why so many babies were living, but they gave an answer to the question, and that's what they were asked to do. And the results of this in society's rules, they feared God. Verse 20, so God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. How many times have we read that now? They keep growing. No matter what you do, you try to kill the babies, they keep growing to the hundreds of thousands, to the millions. Even if the midwives deceived Pharaoh by not telling him all the details, that wasn't what God blessed. He blessed them for obeying him, for obeying God, not man. And the worse the persecution against God's plan came, the greater God made that plan succeed. Pharaoh said less, God said more. Pharaoh said stop, God said go. Pharaoh said kill him, God said let him live. I'm getting ready for a great nation to go out of Egypt and give them the land of promise. In verse 21, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Now today, I know some midwives who work here in Casper, and they have children. But in the old days, people who were midwives often had no children of their own. That way they were able, when somebody gave a call, no matter what it was, morning, noon, or night, they could go and help with the delivery of a baby. They were barren, sweet ladies who loved babies but couldn't have any of their own. And that's the tradition that was used there. But what did God do? He says, I love you so much for standing for me, I'm going to give you babies. You say, was that really God's love or was that a punishment? oh, you have teenagers. I'm sorry. We understand. No, what a blessing. I can remember weeping and praying with my wife when we found out we couldn't have children. And she went to that fertility clinic, which is really an infertility clinic, because there was no answer. And the doctor gave her tests that day, gave me tests, said, there's got to be some reason. And finally the doctor said, nothing is in balance, nothing will work. Poor Teresa, you will never have children. And Teresa went out to the car. Before she got to the car, she threw up because she was having morning sickness. And she threw up every day. She went into labor, went into the delivery room and threw up into a bag on the table, delivering the baby. She was happy for that baby to be born. That was the easy part after being sick for every day for 9 months. But I can't imagine. What a blessing. And what's the name of these ladies? Do you know their names? Are they important? Oh yeah, Shifra and Pua. By the way, what's the name of the Pharaoh now? Amoses is one, never mentioned by name. He's dead now. Who's the Pharaoh now? Yeah, Amenhotep. Well, the Bible doesn't say. You realize that? You say, the Pharaoh, the most important of the greatest kingdom in the world of that day, the Bible never mentions it, but two women who stood up to him, now they get their name in the Bible. If God were writing the Bible today, whose names would be written down saying, oh, look at these people in Casper, Wyoming. Look at Bob, Jim, look at them. Their names aren't even there. They feared nothing except God. And God blessed them. The highest official is old what's-his-name in the Bible. But two Hebrew midwives that were probably the leaders of the different women that were serving, they are remembered. Proverbs 10, verse 7 says, the memory of the righteous is a blessing. The names of the wicked will rot. Take that, Pharaoh. Psalm 109:13 says, may his descendants be cut off, may their names be blotted out from the next generation, may their sins remain before the Lord, that he might cut off their memory from all in the earth. Where would we be without these godly women? Where would we be without people who fear God more than they fear the government, more than they fear their neighbor, more than they fear embarrassment? Where would the world be? The Jewish boys would be done. There would be no Moses. There would be no King David. There would be no Jesus. Satan was out to destroy the godly line. Same thing that he started in Eden. But thank God for Shifra and Pua. Thank God for godly women who say, we're going to obey God no matter what it costs. You see, the political, the economic, the social oppression is just a little glimpse into realizing what's behind it all, and that is the spiritual oppression, the satanic pressure that is on. Verse 22 said, so Pharaoh commanded all his people, not just the midwives, everyone, every Egyptian, every son that is born of a Hebrew, throw into the Nile. Every daughter, let her live. A radical escalation The original plan now was a failure. It was miserable. Let's just drown every Jewish boy. Anyone. You say, you mean just the baker down the street? The Egyptian sees a little Jewish boy? Yeah, any. Doesn't matter if they're a newborn or a toddler. You see a baby boy that's Jewish? Kill it. You have the government blessing. Is that day going to come again? It could. In the land of the free and the home of the slaves that we live in today, it could. Destroy Israel in a generation and involve everyone, not just the midwives. Anyone who sees a Jew, kill it. If you've ever seen pictures of Pharaoh, can you all envision a picture of Pharaoh? I'm not going to draw one up here on the whiteboard. They've got that big crowny gold thing. What's right in the middle of it up the top? Yeah, a big snake head. A big snake head with rubies in its eyes. Because that old serpent, Satan, was behind Pharaoh. He's behind the government leaders. And I mentioned just in reference Herod the Great. Satan used his jealousy. You know, Herod was so fearful of who would take over his throne. He built the temple. He built different palaces. He built fortresses. He did all this. Built a beautiful city out in the desert next to old Jericho. Beautiful swimming pool there. I've been there. It doesn't have water in it now, but the mosaic tile and things are still there. You can walk right through it. Well, this is amazing. You know what happened there? Herod's two sons were swimming there one night. And Herod said, they could take my throne. They could rebel against me. I can't trust my own sons. I know how evil they are. They get it from their mother, I guess. I'm not sure. And so that night he ordered his servants to simply go out and drown his two sons in the new swimming pool that he built for them. So don't think it unusual when Herod gets word that the new king of the Jews is born in Bethlehem, and he gets irritated that the wise men left and headed back from Jerusalem a different way, across the fords and the Dead Sea, rather than going back through Jerusalem and back east. And that he said, okay, we'll just kill all the babies. Let's see, the star showed a couple years ago, so any baby that's three or under, we will kill. And we won't just do it in Bethlehem, because we're not sure exactly where it is. We'll go all the way up to Ramah, 10 miles north of Jerusalem, all of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, 10 miles south, 20 miles below that to Hebron. We'll go through that whole area and we'll kill every Jewish boy and kill off the rival. Pharaoh's plan didn't succeed any better than Herod's plan. Because as we know from the New Testament, that God warned Joseph of the plan and said, you need to go to Egypt and find safety there. And then lead God's child, the Son of God, out of Egypt to the promised land. A wonderful New Testament parallel to the Exodus. Today we have parallels to Pharaoh, parallels to Herod, parallels to Hitler. Disdain for those who threaten our self-interest. Look at babies as an economic liability. We don't want that. You realize what it costs? If you had a baby, you realize what it costs to raise a baby now? It used to cost. I remember when we found out we were pregnant, and I looked at the statistics, and it was like it would take $32,000 to raise a baby from infancy through college. $32,000. I think today if it was $532,000, that might be low. I'm not sure. Be thankful. Some of you guys are look at your mom and dad right now. You better give them a hug. Be thankful that they didn't just decide like the whole that you're an economic liability and throw you in the plat. I don't know. The killing is subtle at first. Today it's just a blob of tissue, nothing big. But then it became the Holocaust, where no matter what reason, no matter what cause, kill them. The cosmic battle is still raging. We close with this. God's plan. Because from the human perspective of this battle, things in Egypt were going from bad to worse. The royal welcome had been changed to serfdom and then to outright slavery and now genocide. Was God aware? Yes. Did he know what was happening? Yes. Did he allow it to happen? Yes. Why wasn't he more involved? Why didn't he do something? I mean, in one generation, from 1576 to 1525, 50 years of increasing stress and slavery and misery, where was God? When bad things happen, where is God? He's on his throne, where he's always been and always will be. Someone said, why do bad things happen to good people? And I tell them it only happened once, and it's because he volunteered. From the Egyptian perspective, they're sinful, selfish. We don't want to lose workers. We don't want to lose money. We don't want to lose this whole bunch here. We're going to just keep them, and we'll just get rid of the nation end of it, and we'll just live happily ever after. From the midwife's perspective, they said, we don't care what the law says. We're going to serve God. If it means we're killed by Pharaoh, we die. Threaten me with heaven. How terrible will that be? And from God's perspective, the battle was engaged. The serpent against the seed. The promised Messiah versus all of the devil's wiles to try and destroy it. The affliction and bondage that was foretold. Remember last message in Genesis 15? He said for 430 years you're going to be in bondage. It's like the Jews didn't want to believe that. God doesn't put stuff in his word just for fun. It happened until every minute of it was gone. And they didn't see the blessing of suffering. You see, Israel was saved from absorption into the Canaanite land. Judgment to the Canaanites was delayed. The light of God's salvation and redemption was poured on the Egyptians. When we get to the Exodus, you say, yes, are we ever going to get there? Okay, we're going through Exodus. They're going to actually leave, and the Jews go out, and hundreds and thousands of Egyptians go with them because they'd heard the gospel. They'd heard of the true God. They'd worshiped the true God. And they left Egypt in its false religion. And Egypt grew from 70 to 2 million people, a virtual army prepared for the rigors of the wilderness, prepared for the invasion of their promised land. You see, God's purposes are being fulfilled and we don't see them. When we're not even involved sometimes, we forget that God is in control. When we're not aware of it, when the world looks like it's all falling apart to us, and you say, oh, this can't be right. Where is God? God is still working. When God is silent, as he was for 400 years, think about that. A generation would be born, they'd become adults, they worked, they slaved, they had families, they grew up, they grew old, and they died. Generation after generation after generation. But they all knew the promise that one day redemption would come. God's purposes are there. They're going to be fulfilled. And his work can be done as easily in adversity as it is in affluence. The parallel to Israel and their exodus to our life today is very obvious. We started this message talking about the emphasis to show God's faithfulness. Now, I enjoyed a birthday this week. Okay, that's good enough. Okay. And as soon as I did, my wife came and gave me a big hug, and she said, "Happy 69th birthday. Do you know that your next birthday you'll be 70? I said, "Thank you, dear, for that sweet message." But you know what? If I were writing a book, The Gospel of Bob, I could talk about God's faithfulness even when I didn't see it happening. When things occurred in my life that I didn't even realize were going on. When challenges came and God did. We write the story of God's work in our lives. And maybe we need to get out of the way and let the pen move by the Spirit of God. Because we want to reflect it ourselves. We want to say, "Oh, you know, boy, this is a difficult time." For my birthday, I got a book called the Grandpa's Memory Book. I don't know if any of you men have gotten one of those. You know, you get it, and it says there, you know, who was your best friend in third grade? And what sports did you like to play when you were nine? And it's page after page. And, you know, my sons that got together and gave me that evil book said, we want you to write down these things so that we'll remember. And so your grandkids will remember. And they'll see what God did in your life when you're gone. We don't know the names of any of these people. Millions of people in 430. Well, we know Shifra and Pua. Okay, we know those two names. And we know Moses' mom and dad. We're going to get to them in the next message. But our names mean nothing. The message is what needs to go out. The message of God's faithfulness. His redeeming hand is with us. The worrier will edit out all the good things and the positive possibilities and highlight every pain and disaster and all. Oh, that's just the way we are. The grumbler, they're writing down their story and say, "Oh, God didn't really bless, and look how terrible the world is, and this is painful, and this is unpleasant," and pretty soon you get an organ recital, you know, that's what they're going to give. But the faithful recognizes God is in control. He recognizes the evil in life, but emphasizes the good. He sees the problems, but knows that there is a God. Faith chooses to live on the promises and the purposes and the power of God, to see his hand at work, even though there is political and economic and social and spiritual oppression, that God is preparing us and preparing our children and grandchildren, preparing our nation for a great blessing. The light of redemption is shining. It's like the daybreak. I don't know if any of you get up real early in the morning. I try not to do that. But, you know, you can get up in the morning and you can look out to the east. Right? And you can look out to the east. And you can't see the sun. The sky up above us and to the west is pitch black. But over there on the eastern horizon, it's starting to glow. It's starting to turn a lighter shade of blue. And you're looking there and you're saying, "The sun's going to come up." And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for the sun.